my boss is in the back of the room, so I didn't set him up for that. But I appreciate the kind words, Tom. And it is a pleasure for me to be here today and to have the opportunity to visit with you about some of the issues that we're facing on the research side. And I'm going to speak broadly this morning. I'm not going to speak from a government perspective necessarily. I'm going to speak from a research perspective. And I'm going to speak from a production research perspective. And I'll define that as I go through my comments this morning about what that means. You've heard a lot of history from Ike, and you'll continue to hear a lot of history throughout this meeting as we commemorate this 40th anniversary of BIF. And I have to think that when those people gathered in Denver in January of 1967, and they were faced with thinking about what the opportunities were to use performance data, as it was evolving at the time, and artificial insemination was beginning to take off, and computing technology was sitting out there in the future for how we might be able to couple all of those things, that they really had to have a tremendous amount of foresight to realize what might come down the road. And at that time, they were really just thinking about coupling data with computing technology and existing statistical methodology and statistical theory. And we know the result from that. You've heard a lot about it already this morning. The result is that we have technologies available today, 40 years later, for evaluation of animals within breeds and characterization of animals across breeds and germplasm that they represent for a pretty wide variety of traits. You just answered a lot of questions in Kent's talk about how you use those and how you employ those in your systems. We have a lot of good future ahead of us, I think, for even broadening this out further, for a lot of traits that we have yet to add to this list, both within breeds and on a multi-breed basis. And you've talked about that in Kent's presentation previously. Now, I just want to challenge you a bit here. Now, I'm going to pick up on where Kent gave me a segue to think about where we're standing on the cliff today. Because I would wager to you that we are, in fact, on a new cliff. They were on a cliff in 1967. We're on a cliff in 2007. And it's not because we wonder what new data may come along. There's new data will come for a lot of new traits. But this real perplexing puzzle now is getting added to with this whole DNA mess. And you've heard that referred to already in Kent's talk. And I just want to stimulate you to think a bit about what's coming at you, and coming at you very, very, very quickly. Ike made reference to the fact that we are developing new tools in genomics. We have invested a tremendous amount of resources, particularly over the last 20 years, in chasing genes. No doubt about it. And I'm not going to go through all the history of how that has evolved, because that history is in itself rich. But if you look today at what is available from that investment, you might argue that that list is relatively narrow. Diagnostics of a few genes or markers of genes, and more recently suites of markers for some traits, from the result of that large investment in genomics work, both in the public domain and in the private domain. But here's what's happening that's coming at you very rapidly. Ike referred to it in his comments. We have most recently put a lot of dollars both in the private domain, MMI was involved in this early on, and in the public domain in terms of sequencing the genome. And we have done that not only for cattle, we also have done that for competing protein sources. For swine that is now being sequenced, for the chicken genome, and other genomes that are important agriculturally. And you have heard the story. I talked about it at this meeting a couple of years ago. In Montana, that we were sequencing the genome and what some of the results of that might be. It's an expensive project. It is now done. We do now have that sequence available in the public domain. And I'm not going to dwell on the technicalities here, but what I want you to understand is what's coming from it. Okay? And this next series of slides, I hope will stimulate you to think what is happening around the world as a result of having these kinds of tools available. There is an international effort that's been going on now for roughly 2 years that we refer to as the International Bovine Haplotype Map, or HapMap for short, project. It involves researchers from a number of countries around the world. It involves breed associations, including a number of the U.S. associations, in the effort, where the idea has been to take as many new markers that have been gleaned from that bovine genome project and put them out into the public domain to enable both discovery of genes and what we refer to as whole genome selection as fast and as efficiently as possible. So, to make a long story short, this group has now evaluated 40,000 new genetic markers called SNPs across a wide variety of breeds, 19 different breeds, to validate those SNPs and put them out there for use in the research community. On top of that, there are now efforts that have grown out beyond that that are seeking to add markers very quickly to that suite. This is an effort that Jerry Taylor's involved in on the beef side and Steve Moore in Canada. Our researchers in the dairy side with NARS, Kurt Van Tassel and his group at Beltsville, where they have just released, literally last week, to one of the genotyping companies, 60,000 new SNP markers on top of the 40,000 that came from that large international consortium effort I mentioned a moment ago. Now, you're probably wondering by now what that has to do with you. Here's what it has to do with you. What we see coming at you very, very rapidly is evaluation of technology that we're referring to as whole genome selection, where whole genome selection means if we have 100,000 SNP markers that are distributed very widely throughout the genome, like these are that I just described to you, can we throw that tool now at quantitative traits that we have well phenotyped to begin to say maybe we don't need genes. Maybe all we need is these markers to be able to evaluate in a very young sense young animals for these traits with relatively high accuracy. Getting at Kent's point a few minutes ago, is that going to work? We're going to find out very rapidly, because the genotyping technology has moved and progressed to a stage now where we can genotype this large number of markers for relatively low cost per animal. If you're with me. Am I too close? Sorry. Okay. Can you still hear me okay? Sorry. So we have genotyping platforms out there, like the one shown on this slide, where we can do that genotyping of 100,000 markers for literally fractions of a penny per genotype. And when you do the math, that tells you that we're becoming very affordable to do this in a research sense very, very quickly. So here's where it's headed. What I want you to think of is the end result and the end game today. Think about now as you stand here at BIF in 2007, put yourself back in a Sal Forbes context in 1967. This is what you're looking at out there in the future. Having tools and technology that will take you to adding value to these traits, and for many traits that we don't even have data on yet, through employment of this technology along the bottom side of that slide, adding to the phenotypes that we have and the pedigree information that we have to have genome-enabled selection. That's what's out there in the future for us, and I think it's coming at us faster than we may realize that it is. We have a lot of traits that have yet to be evaluated. I like to use the term phenomics to combine the importance of phenotypes to put with these genomics types of research efforts for peace of mind traits, for adaptability traits, for functionality traits. Things that we have not done a very good job of evaluating up to this point. Those are the traits that you still have out there. We see a lot of work already going on in feed efficiency, certainly. How much work do we have going on in disease resistance? That's a real area of growth for us. That's where a lot of our future improvement we think will lie. Stress resistance, as I'll show you here in a slide in a moment, something we're getting a fair amount of pressure on from the public, whether we like it or not, that we may need to be thinking about. So are we going to follow the human lead, where they already are doing this on human disease, using these whole genome scans to study animal diseases of importance? I think we will. We will see that happen, and we will see it happen relatively rapidly over the next decade in work that we intend to invest in. You might see on the bottom line of this slide, the human genome folks have decided in the last 12 months that they intend to invest significant resources in understanding the microbiome, they're calling it, of the human. The gut and all of the organisms in the gut, every organism that comes in and out of the seven orifices, as they describe it, of the human body. Now think about the applications of that to the livestock industry. In understanding the dynamics of the rumen, for example, and the cow, and things that we may be able to do to better understand that with some of these kinds of technologies. So with that as a backdrop, we have spent at USDA, and Deb Hammernick, my colleague from CSRES, is in the audience today, the last 2 years thinking about what direction are we going to take with all these tools to try to do as good a job as we possibly can to deliver things to our constituents in the industry. And we are just in the process of releasing this USDA Animal Genomics Blueprint. This is the logo we're using for it. And I just want to point out to you how this is going to impact you downstream. Those top three items there that are deliverables to the industry, or our hope of deliverables, are getting to that slide of genome-enabled genetic evaluation. Using the tools that we're developing, adding molecular data to quantitative data, and delivering genome-enabled genetic evaluation. But equally important is using that information to do precision mating, both within and across breeds. And the fourth one down there of precision management systems is something that we've not traditionally dealt with at BIF, but is going to be an outcome, and I think a fairly large outcome, of these kinds of technologies, in that if we can predict the genetic value of these animals using some of these technologies, we therefore will be able to design the management system appropriately to match that genotype, i.e. sorting of the genetics of our animals that are out there in the production systems. So that's what's ahead of us. Now here's the challenges I want to offer to you. We are at a crossroads in research for a lot of different reasons, and I just want to point out a few of them to you. Anybody that's existed in this industry over the last decade knows that we've had a lot of dissension on topics that we have disagreed on, whether it deals with trade policy or whether it deals with that national animal ID, whether it deals with country of origin labeling, all kinds of policy issues, whether it deals with the impact of increasing consolidation and integration and what that may mean for the marketplace, even dissension on the value of the checkoff. We've all seen that and lived through it over the last several years. There are also some pretty macro societal and industry shifts that are occurring out there that impact what kinds of research we should be doing. Things like increasing calls for, and this is the new buzzword in Washington, decreasing the environmental footprint of animal production. We all know the discussion about competition for our feedstuffs. It's front and center, certainly been front and center over the last year. Increased attention to animal well-being and welfare. It is there, folks, and it's not going away. Increased brand, process, / historical identity of our products. We have seen that grow in the market. We will continue to see that grow in the beef marketplace. And this last one's one that we have been seeing a lot more attention to in the last year. We certainly are hearing it a lot from our stakeholders. Increased purchasing power for non-traditionally produced beef products, whether that be grass-fed, natural, organic, whatever label you want to put on it. It's there, and it's growing, and it's real. Now, here's some micro shifts that deal more with this particular audience. And I'm going to capsulize everything Ken Anderson said in these four bullet points in a way. Now, I want you to think where you stand on several of these issues. We have had a push to narrow the gene pool, right? Increased product consistency, quality, so forth. The easiest way to do that is to narrow the gene pool. But there's quite a bit of disagreement, and I saw it in some of your responses in that last talk, about the value of heterosis in the cow herd. That's still an issue that's unresolved. The need for information continues to accelerate. We need more traits. We need more economically relevant trait information for a lot of these adaptability and functionality and health traits, healthfulness traits of our product. There is a desire to move from the breed world that we have lived in to a gene pool wide world for the future. So if we remember the commercial industry we serve, there's certainly a desire there to move beyond talking about a breed world. And as I mentioned to you in a lot of my first slides, this mining of in the post-genome sequence era that we are now in of information from that tool is here to stay. And we will see that work continue for some time in the future. There are new names in the business. There are new linkages in the business of genetics in our industry. A lot of these all deal with the DNA side, largely. And they are creating new information that, as you said here a few minutes ago, is contributing to confusion for you in how we sort that out. We have our challenges ahead of us in standardizing what we do with all of these new kinds of data. Furthermore, I don't think it's any secret to any of us in the room that have been in this business for a long time that there has been significant financial redirection of research, education, and extension efforts over the last 25 years. Simply in genetics research, genetic evaluation research, quantitative genetics research, as compared to molecular genetics research that you heard me talk about earlier, the resources have been redirected from the former to the latter. As positions have come open in land-grant universities or in the government, those positions have been converted over to molecular biology positions to address these new technologies. And as a result, this group and NCBA and others in recent years recognized that that critical mass of brains had declined to an issue of concern. And the NBCEC that John Pollock has provided such great leadership for over the last several years was formed and funded as a result of that. I think some of you are probably aware that even that effort currently is a little bit on the blocks in terms of its funding coming from USDA in a permanent sense. And that needs to be addressed. We need to make sure that we have that infrastructure there in the future in order to move a lot of these areas forward. I would wager to you this morning, and I hope if you get nothing else out of what I said, you'll remember this slide, that beef cattle breeding and genetics research, education, and extension, needs a renaissance. It needs a reawakening. Because we are standing on the edge of a cliff in a lot of respects. And if we don't invest in that infrastructure in order to address a lot of those things, I think we're going to pay a significant price for that. So BIF, I think in 2007, needs to think about some fundamental questions. One of them is as simple as this. Where are the scientists and the educators going to come from that have the knowledge of the industry and the industry's problems to be able to address them? It's one thing to say that you can create a lot of molecular biologists, but I'll tell you, folks, there's some really good molecular biologists around in our ranks now, but there aren't that many of them that know one end of a cow from another one. And I'm just going to be real blunt about it. Kendra Gordon did an article for Angus Journal here recently. Some of you may have seen it, that highlighted what were called some university trailblazers, younger scientists and educators who did come to the industry to work for the industry, from the industry. And you see the names that are up there of some of those folks that are making an impact. Where are we going to pull those people from in the future, and who's going to educate them? I think we need to seriously think about that. How are we going to fill the deficit of quantitatively skilled people, which has been the hallmark of BIF, to jump over this cliff? and address these challenges of how to use all these new kinds of data. I think we need to reopen the textbook on quantitative genetics, quite frankly, and train some people to fill those slots. Who is going to educate the public? Kent made a strong point of this in his talk on all of these new technologies. Is it going to be under the models and the platforms that we've used in the past? I don't know the answer to that. NCBA, Connie Quinn and a group looked at that here a few years ago. We need to be thinking seriously about how we're going to educate folks on these new technologies that are coming so rapidly. What is going to be the role of breed associations in the future? It's a valid question. You know, I remember when I was here in Fort Collins during the 1990s and all the discussion that LMA had about what's the role of the sale barn going to be in the future. You remember that discussion that led to some of this dissension that we've had in the industry in the past? I would ask the same question currently to the breed associations. Are you going to seize the day, for lack of a better way of putting it, to deal with some of these issues, and how do you intend to do that? Are we looking closely enough at what's happening around the world? One of the privileges that I've had in the position that I'm in today is I get to travel a lot, and I get to spend a lot of time overseas. And it is amazing to me what is happening in some of the regions around the world, particularly down under, in terms of looking at how they're going to employ some of these technologies and the models they're going to use to do it and capitalize on them. We need to be studying that very, very, very carefully. We also need to be studying what's happening in our other industries, particularly the dairy industry, and how they're going to employ some of these technologies to learn some lessons from them. Now, I think Brian's going to pick up on some of this, and I don't want to drill it in too hard, but I think you do need to know that there are efforts and there are folks that believe that animal agriculture doesn't belong in the U.S. anymore. I'm not trying to raise a flag. I'm not trying to raise any threats. But there are a lot of social conscience groups out there that would just assume we not exist. And we need to be cognizant of that in addressing some of our research in the future. Is there adequate funding out there today to address these challenges? Clearly the answer is no. And we need to make sure that we figure out a way how to address that. I don't want you to, how should I say this? Sometimes I think we lose our focus and we worry about if we aren't getting the job done and we need to do the job a little differently, let's reorganize. So there's always a call to reorganize everything we do whenever we have a challenge out there. I don't want to lose our focus and get into that discussion because this is where we need to be. We need to remember that we have a lot of stuff we don't know about inputs into a cow herd. I used this slide in 1995, first time at a BIF meeting in Sheridan, Wyoming. And it is just as relevant today, if not more so, than it was then. Because, guess what? All of a sudden, the emphasis is getting put on the inputs. And how can we be more efficient? And how can we address how to produce under a little tougher playing field in terms of cost? And that's not going to go away, I don't believe, in the near term. It's a huge paradigm shift for us in the way that we approach things in the future if we're going to be sustainable for this next generation. Donald Brown walked into the back of the room, you remember when he was a little boy, for that next generation of people engaged in this business. Now I just want to close on this same leadership point that Kent closed on in his comments. These folks exhibited a tremendous amount of leadership in this industry. And this isn't the entire list, but they're the ones I could think of off the top of my head when they did this 40 years ago. Remember, the end game is this. I showed it to you earlier. That's the cliff we've got to jump to get to the other side, which is this. There's where we're headed and where we want to be. Now I'm going to take a little personal prerogative here. These are our kids. Our oldest son just graduated from high school, which, you know, is a milestone for Jane and I. We're getting old. It's a milestone for us. But I'm putting this slide up here because I want you to think about the fact that this generation of kids is talented. They're impressive. They're bright. They're aggressive. They're worldly in ways that we weren't. They communicate in ungodly ways that we didn't. And they've seen things happen while they've been growing up that have changed them. There's a lot of people believe they're the next great generation for our country because they saw 9/11 happen. And they believe that the world can be a better place. We need to figure out how to employ them in the beef industry. Not talking about our son Justin necessarily, because I couldn't convince him to do that. But we need to figure out how to employ them to address these problems. And we need an infrastructure out there that will help them do that. So I hope we take that challenge seriously and that we do, in fact, seize the day. Thank you very much, Tom.